From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about a father's fight for justice more than 10 years after his son died, when he was forcefully held down by customers at a West Dallas corner store. Then we'll share some ways to make your lawn friendly to birds and pollinators.
We wanted to start a project to help people do the things that scientists know are good, like plant native plants, reduce chemical usage, and protect their habitats.
Plus, we'll learn how architect Frank Lloyd Wright was inspired by his home state, Wisconsin.
It's really focusing on nature, use of natural materials. I would say organic architecture is really what he's known for, and you see that everywhere today. It continues to be popular.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. In 2012, three customers at a corner store in West Dallas held down Corey Stingley, a black teen who was trying to shoplift. Stingley suffered a traumatic brain injury from loss of oxygen and never regained consciousness. His parents took him off life support 2 weeks later. He was just 16 years old. One person involved in holding Stingley down was arrested shortly after the incident, but none of the men, who were all white, were ever criminally charged. Corey's father has continued to fight for his son. ProPublica reporter Megan O'Matz wrote about Corey Stingley's story and his family's continued push for justice in an article published last month. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain what happened and how the family is still fighting. A note to our listeners, this conversation includes some graphic descriptions that some may find upsetting.
To start us off, can you explain what happened to Corey Stingley at a Food Mart in West Dallas in 2012?
Yes, Corey was 16 years old at the time, and he had gone to the store. He was on his way to a basketball game, and it looked like he was trying to shoplift some Smirnoff ice. So he made what his dad calls, you know, a youthful mistake, probably, you know, a dumb youthful mistake, where he tried to shoplift about six bottles. So he walked up to the counter and he tried to pay for an energy drink. Meanwhile, he had concealed the Smirnoff ice in his backpack. The clerk was aware that Corey had done this and had seen, you know, on the surveillance video in the store. And he asked Corey to hand over his backpack, and then if he returned the merchandise, he wouldn't call police. So Corey did that, and he reached for his debit card back. And he sort of pivoted to leave the store. And at that point is when three grown men who were customers there, they pounced on him, realizing that he was an attempted shoplifting in the store. And they wrestled him to the ground and pinned him there. And in doing so, they used, unfortunately, it's very excessive force, it seems, and Corey ended up dying. He was asphyxiated.
So this was back in 2012, and unfortunately, there hasn't been any real solid conclusion in the court system and in other ways as well. So with that being one primary reason, but what else led you to look deeper into where Corey's case is today and connect with his father, Craig?
Well, Craig had reached out to ProPublica, and he told me his story, which I'm somewhat new to Wisconsin. I've lived here 2 years, and I wasn't familiar with this incident, and it sounded terrible. I couldn't understand how no one was charged. Here, this boy was, yes, admittedly trying to shoplift, but these patrons had held him down, and the local district attorney had determined that there would be no criminal charges because the men did not know of the harm they were causing, and they were intending to hold him for police. But for his dad, that, you know, never made sense, because witnesses had seen one of the men holding Corey in a chokehold. He also ended up, the police found him. He was soaked in urine, foaming at the mouth. So it seemed to the family of Corey that it would be inconceivable that the men did not know the harm that they were causing him by pinning him to the ground. One of the witnesses saw putting Corey in a chokehold. So when Corey's dad contacted ProPublica, he had explained that he was using an obscure part of Wisconsin law, which allows a family to contact a judge, file what's called a John Doe petition with the court to ask for a review if a district attorney is unwilling to prosecute. So Corey's dad, I thought it was remarkable that this would be the third prosecutor that he was able to get appointed to look at this matter. The first DA, again, declined to issue any charges. A second DA had basically sat on the matter for 3 years and did, you know, very little action in it. Then again, issued a one-page memo saying she agreed that there would be no charges. And to me, it was just quite remarkable that he had convinced the court to assign a third district attorney. And it, you know, shows the tenacity of a family in trying to pursue justice.
Right. Now, this third district attorney is a prosecutor in Dane County, Ismail Ozan. And they were scheduled to report back to the court on May 26. Did that announcement happen? What's the current status?
No, actually, that hearing was postponed. We have a new court date on July 6th, where Corey's dad is hoping to hear what the Dane County DA has concluded as to whether there could be possible charges, even at this late date, 10 years later. I will note, though, that the man that witnesses saw putting Corey in a chokehold, Mario Lauman, he died a year ago of natural causes. So that leaves two other individuals who were involved in pinning Corey to the ground. And it will be, you know, very interesting to see what the Dane County DA has to say on that.
In your story and your outreach and trying to speak with people who were involved in this case, what was that like for you? Was it mostly closed doors from some of the people involved, or was anyone surprised that this case is still popping up year after year thanks to Corey's father's persistence?
Well, one of the men involved, I found him at his apartment, and he did come to the door, but, you know, declined to talk with me. The other individual I pursued through visits to his home and calls and letters, and, you know, was never able. He just obviously was not willing to talk about this. So I did reach one of the witnesses from the case, and even 10 years later, that witness was still deeply disturbed about what he saw. He basically told us that the three men he thought, you know, wanted to be heroes that day. And in doing so, they took the life of a 16-year-old boy. Again, shoplifting is not a capital offense. This boy lost his life for making that kind of mistake.
You also write about how Corey's case parallels a recent deadly subway incident in New York City. Can you share how they're similar, but then, of course, where the case in Wisconsin here takes a sharp turn?
Yes, in New York, your listeners might remember recently a former Marine put a black man in a chokehold on a New York subway because that man had been acting erratically. And in that case, the Marine, Dan Penny, has said that he thought that the individual was a danger, even though he had, you know, not expressed, not made any attempts to commit any violence at the time. Now, in New York, the district attorney there did press charges, manslaughter charges, within a couple weeks. And that case is, of course, still proceeding through the courts. But that's a far different situation than we saw here in Milwaukee, where the DA found that, again, a former, I might say that we discovered that the man that put Corey in a chokehold was also a former Marine, and there were no charges brought.
Along with the no charges brought, what are some of the other factors that are contributing to this case getting perpetually held up in court, it seems?
Well, Corey's family has told me that when they met with the Milwaukee County DA John Chisholm, he told the family then that he thought that it would be very difficult for him to win a case in Milwaukee because of the racial problems within the county, the segregated nature of the county, the fact that these men were holding Corey down for the police. And he basically said he didn't think he could win a conviction. And that has not sat well with the family because they wanted him to try to bring charges that if you don't prosecute these kinds of situations, then people may think they're free to do so without any consequences. So the DA's office, I will say, did not comment for us because of the ongoing review in Dane County. So I don't know whether they would actually dispute that that was said in the meeting with the Stingley family.
As we continue to wait for this next court date on July 6th, and in reading your story and looking at some of the parallels, but some of the longstanding issues as well, what have been some of your takeaways? What's impacted you the most from this story and in speaking with Corey's family?
Well, the one thing that has really made an impression on me is that other people have compared this to a modern day lynching. And when you think about lynchings in the past, they are those horrendous acts that were done for some kind of perceived injustice against Black people. And we think that these are, of course, long ago acts, but you can see that there can be some kind of parallels. Although, again, the men involved insist that they had no intention to harm Corey, that they were just trying to hold him for police, that they were unaware of the harm that they were causing him. But they did act with extreme force to hold him for police when they could have just, you know, let him leave. As the clerk had said, if you leave, I won't call police if you give me back my merchandise. And Corey did that. He handed back his backpack and the merchandise, and he was headed out the door.
As you mentioned, you were kind of newly familiar, reacquainting yourself with this case, being newer to Wisconsin. What do you want readers to think about and learn, whether they remember when this happened back in 2012 or, similar to you, are learning about it now in a new light in regards to the New York subway incident and drawing those parallels as well?
Well, we're in a new era, of course, because of the Black Lives Matter movement and the incident with George Floyd. So certainly there is a reawakening, if you want to say, about the kind of extreme force that is used, whether by police or ordinary citizens, against Black people in this society. And I think it bears a review and remembering of cases that occurred before we were necessarily more in tune with all of this. Now, I will say as well that the surveillance video in the situation from the store was somewhat grainy, and a lot of the action, if you will, happened outside of the camera's view, where so many other incidents that we are seeing have video from people's phones and all. So we have a much better appreciation now for what's going on because of all the video that's out there.
Well, Megan, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share more about this story, and we will wait for that update on July 6th, hopefully.
Thank you. Thank you for talking with me about it. I appreciate it.
Megan Omatz is a reporter for ProPublica in Wisconsin. You can find her article at WUWM.com. Omatz spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn how Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture was inspired by Wisconsin and how you can explore some of these spaces around Milwaukee. But first, we'll share some ways you can help pollinators and birds thrive in your yard. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. No Mow May is a trend that's been catching on in the last few years. Homeowners letting their yards grow long can help bees and other pollinators. But your yard can be a haven for pollinators beyond May if you have the right trees, plants, and grasses planted in them. The Lake Michigan Bird Observatory has a project underway to help homeowners keep their yards pollinator and bird-friendly year-round. It's called the Neighborhood Habitat Improvement Project, and it came to life when Jennifer Phillips Vanderberg came on as the observatory's director. She joins WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz to explain.
When I was brand new 3 years ago, I looked around and looked at what we could do as a small nonprofit to help birds in the region. And what I realized is, even though scientists know what individuals need to do to help birds, it's really hard for people to do it. And we wanted to start a project to help people do the things that scientists know are good, like plant native plants, reduce chemical usage, and protect their habitats, and try to turn that into things that are manageable, that they can do, and build projects around that. So we work a lot with different communities, and it's really exciting that we're now expanding throughout the whole Lake Michigan region, from Green Bay, basically along the entire Lake Michigan corridor.
So when you look at this space, it was no mowed, you know, purposely, but mm-hmm. it's time to mow. Mm-hmm. Are there weeds or plants you can identify, like, I definitely would yank this out or that out?
There are some weeds that they're just really tough to remove, like Creeping Charlie, which I'm seeing in there. It's a real tough one because if you pull it out, it sends out runners, and each individual runner can live on its own. So if you tear out a middle part of it, it'll just create two new ones, and it'll just keep doing that. So one thing that in certain areas that works, if you have a really badly infested area and want to transition to something else, what we advocate and I've done at my house is to smother it. So leave it for a growing season, because Creeping Charlie is pretty tough. Basically put layers of cardboard down and then put mulch on top, and then wait until the next year to plant, and you'll be ready to go. And your weeds should be dead under there if you're converting it to a bed or native plants or something like that. The other option is you can, especially if you don't walk on it a lot, another option is to plant some more aggressive ground cover, native ground covers that stay low. And there are some natives that you can put into your lawn either through overseeding or just pulling out your sod first and then putting down things like helol. That's a native that will stay short enough and can be mowed, that people often incorporate into yards that are dense enough that they can suppress some weeds and still support pollinators at the same time. One thing we try to get people to think about is, which things do you really need to treat? Because by default, a lot of people just blanket it all. They hire a service and treat the whole thing. And trying to think instead about, what are the things that I love that really need it, versus can we let some other things go? Because it's just something that covers the ground, and as long as it's not too pokey, is it okay? Is it okay to have clover in your yard? Is it okay to have helol in your yard? Because while clover isn't native, it does support some pollinators, and it doesn't need any of the chemicals that a lot of times grass does, and it still can suppress weeds. So it's kind of discussions like that how can you take a step forward, even if it isn't all natives? So a lot of times around beds, having large-leaved plants, like, say, big-leafed aster is one of the ones we recommend. They really can suppress weeds. And by having a nice dense patch of flowering plants that will host pollinators, but you're also reducing weeding. And that kind of trying to figure out how individuals' problems can be met with other solutions than what we've typically seen in traditional landscaping. So it's not about rewilding your whole yard overnight, even though we do have a couple of people who are doing that. For most people, it's taking one chunk that might be a little overgrown and turning it into something that is low maintenance, that you can maintain at the level that you're comfortable maintaining it. And that's a discussion that we have with all of our partners and with our program participants.
Are there any other basic techniques that are part of people getting started?
One thing is trees. Most people don't really think about if their trees are native or not native. So when you tell someone, how about you go for a nice native maple instead of, say, an invasive Norway maple, which a lot of people have planted historically, most people don't really appreciate the difference because it serves the same function, like as a shade tree. But it does a lot of good for insects and birds because birds eat a lot of Lepidoptera, which are butterflies and moths, especially their larvae, so caterpillars. So when you have plants that host a lot of them, birds have a lot of food. And the workhorses of Lepidoptera larvae hosting are really our trees. So if you can get people to put in oak trees, maples, birches, willows, those are kind of all really great. And it's not a huge maintenance request. And a lot of people are losing ash trees right now. It's an easy conversation to have of, you're thinking about replacing that really sad ash tree. How about, think about a native.
You touched on this earlier. Are you finding surprising, you know, categories of people, I don't want to generalize, who are jumping aboard, who might be surprising themselves?
It's been really interesting because there are different categories of folks. Some who really want to rewild things, like one of our volunteers who is absolutely awesome, is removing her whole front yard. She smothered the whole thing and planted it. So there's like very gung-ho people that are kind of in that category. And then there are a lot of bird people who are really in it for birds. So they really look for those species that have the top value for birds. And then there are a lot of folks who are really motivated by pollinators. And a lot of those do overlap with birds. So that's the good news, is we can do things, great things for both. And then there's a group of people who have a relatively traditional landscape. So they want to fit in kind of native plants into the aesthetic that they already have established. So it means a lot of really tailored choice of those plants, because most native plants have evolved because they're natives to spread, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, but a lot of times they will expand and or have some receding because that's how nature works. They have to replace themselves. And if you don't breed them to do that less, they'll keep doing what they've always done for thousands of years. So it's choosing the right species for those landscapes that act more like ornamental plants. So things that keep their shape, they aren't particularly aggressive in spreading, and can fit that same kind of look that people are going for with more space between individual plants. Because a lot of times in natural systems, what you see are plants in kind of a field or at a relatively high density, often with prairie planting, supporting each other. So when you take them out of that, sometimes they flop over, sometimes they spread, sometimes they do all different kinds of things. But there are a group of plants that will stay compact, stay put, and so it's really just matching those plants that have those characteristics with people who have kind of those aesthetics. And then kind of the last group, I think, are people who are concerned about chemicals. So concerned about safety of their kids, themselves, and these chemicals getting into water bodies. So everybody gets their water from somewhere. And in the Milwaukee area and up in Port Washington, where the observatory is, it's from the lake. So all of this stuff is just going into the lake and trying to reduce our chemical inputs only does good things for us drinking it. When we started this, I had no idea what people would say, but I knew the only way to actually help people change their behaviors was to understand where they're coming from and to build programs based on what they think. It doesn't matter what a person with a PhD thinks. We need to take into account what people actually think and how they think about their landscape and what they want to accomplish with it before we can build programs to help them change. Because a lot of the information is kind of one size fits all right now, is like, you should plant native plants and you should just go do that. And we didn't want to be one of those programs. I wanted a program that would get as tailored as we could, help people with their actual problems, and be in communities and be a resource for folks so that it doesn't seem like just some random person coming out here and telling you to change your entire lawn.
Jennifer Phillips Vanderberg is the director of the Lake Michigan Bird Observatory. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Frank Lloyd Wright is arguably the most famous architect in modern history. But did you know he's originally from Wisconsin? He was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin in 1867, and that setting became the inspiration for much of his work. Author Christine Hansen explores this history in her new book, Frank Lloyd Wright's Wisconsin: How America's Most Famous Architect Found Inspiration in His Home State. She joins me now to share some of her favorite buildings from the book and share how you too can check them out. Christine, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me, Joy.
So Frank Lloyd Wright is, I would say, the most iconic architect in modern American history, and his style has had a huge impact on American homes. What are some of the key things to understand about Wright's design, specifically for people who might not be familiar with it?
You're right. He's had a very, very long-standing career, and what's interesting about his career is that it went through many phases. But what he's known for most is this term called organic architecture. And what this means is that you're specifically looking at the site that the house or the apartment or building or hotel or what have you will be built on, and you're trying to incorporate it into that site. You might build into the hillside. It's really focusing on nature. Nature's coming through the windows. There's a lot of glass windows, doors, use of natural materials. I would say organic architecture is really what he's known for, and you see that everywhere today. It continues to be popular.
Of course, the title of this book, or the subtitle, I should say, is How America's Most Famous Architect Found Inspiration in His Home State, which is Wisconsin. How is he inspired by Wisconsin itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is the title of the book. So if anyone's been to Spring Green, Richland Center, that's where he was raised. And it was kind of like a commune, for lack of a better word. And the reason I say a commune is because a lot of people live there, his family members, his extended family. And if you've been to that area, you've seen the rolling green hills. And I really believe that that's what inspired him to use nature as a guide and a principle for architecture.
Now, of course, if you go throughout the state, you're going to find a lot of examples of Wright's work. We're really going to focus on kind of southeastern Wisconsin, so either in Milwaukee itself or day trips. So there are, as you mentioned, of course, a number of examples of his work in the Milwaukee area. I'm going to start with some homes that, to me, really speak to his style and his motivation to some extent. The Burnham Block American System homes. If you're not familiar with the South Side, these are a few homes off historic Layton Boulevard in Milwaukee's Burnham Park neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Burnham Block is six homes, all designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, and they are examples of American system-built homes. That was Wright's attempt to, working with developer Arthur Richards, create homes that were more for the working class, because that by that point, he had designed houses like the Martin House in Buffalo, New York, that is massive. I mean, it's clearly for a certain type of person of a certain means. And so we have six of these all in one block, and it's incredible. I mean, people come from all over the world to visit those. And for people that live here in the city, I don't think they often realize how accessible these are, and you can tour those. It's fascinating. They're considered micro in size, but because they're designed so well with the built-ins and the fireplace, and again, bringing that natural light in, they feel a lot larger than they really are. Many of those houses on that block are duplexes. What's really cool is that one of those is available for rent by the night on VRBO.com. So if you really want to have that experience of living inside a Frank Lloyd Wright house, for a one-night commitment, it's totally there in our city.
Very nice. Now, to me, one of his most unusual buildings is one of the most famous in Milwaukee and beyond, Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church in Wauwatosa. If you haven't been to this space, I highly recommend it. In many ways, even though its exterior is intriguing, it belies this greater grandeur inside.
Yeah, that building is amazing. Many people are probably familiar with it. there's a lot of open land around it. So if you're driving on that side of town and you think you see a saucer, you have seen the house. And I think that that project is a great example of how Wright was really open to doing a lot of different things. He did not just design houses. He also designed churches, including this one in the First Unitarian Society in Madison, also a mausoleum in Buffalo, New York. So there's a lot of a dog house for a client in Northern California. And he did not like dogs, so he really bent his convictions there. But with that project, I mean, he's not of that faith, but he really listened to what they wanted, executed what they wanted, but also put his own spin on it. And that's, you know, why people hire Frank Lloyd Wright is because you're sold into his designs. And a lot of the houses that he designed came with furniture that he designed. And so you're really buying into the lifestyle of what he designs for living at that time.
With this idea of furniture inside of the space and kind of how it can often mirror the different parts of the building itself. One of the most quintessentially, to me, Wright buildings is the S.C. Johnson Administration Building and Research Tower in Racine. If you haven't been there, which I have not been there, but you will likely recognize some of the photographs of it. It has these large umbrella-like columns on the inside, rounded desks that mirror the shapes presented in the building's design. It's very iconic.
It is. And so that consists of two buildings. There's a research tower, which you can see from many parts of Racine. It's not a skyscraper, but it's definitely got some height. And the administration building, which you just mentioned, the workroom. I mean, it has got to be one of the most beautiful workplaces I have ever seen. And it's just amazing the way that he designed it, the desks, which now Steelcase has reproduced. So if you look at those pictures and you say, you know, I'd really like a desk like that, you can now purchase it.
There we go.
So it just shows how much his designs are still resonating with people many years later.
And all of the spaces we've talked about so far, these are all spaces that you can visit. I think there's different tour information for each space, but they are open to the public.
Exactly. And another one we haven't talked about is Wingspread, which was owned by the Johnson family of Johnson Wax fame, S.C. Johnson. And that is in Wind Point. Beautiful property. I've talked to many people as well who have been to conferences there. There's now a conference center on site. But that is such a beautiful building. It's free to tour. The first time I went there, it was raining, and there was a couple who had just arrived from the airport by way of Texas. So it just shows you how popular these designs are. And the first time I toured Taliesin years ago, there were people from New Zealand. So we really are lucky here in Milwaukee to have access to all these projects to tour.
Now, one of the spaces that you talk about in the book, although it is not really Frank Lloyd Wright, it is one of his students. I grew up across the street from it. I have to say, I just went there to get a library card, and the inside is amazing. They've done a beautiful renovation. But the entryway is particularly iconic, and I'm speaking, of course, of the Lake Geneva Public Library.
Yeah, I felt like it was really important when I was working on this book to not ignore how he himself had inspired other architects in the state. And one of those is James Dresser. He designed the Lake Geneva Public Library, which just did a major restoration renovation last year, working with an architecture firm in Oconomowoc. James Dresser also designed two restaurants in Wisconsin Dells, because it was important to me in writing this book, I want to have places that people can visit and do more than a drive-by and possibly disturb the inhabitants of that home. So Fields at the Wilderness and the Dell Bar, which is a supper club in Wisconsin Dells. So that's why I included his work as well as a few other protégés, because that library has got to be one of the most beautiful libraries I have ever seen. Plus, it's framing the view of Geneva Lake, and it's just incredible. I'm so glad you had a chance to visit it.
It is a beautiful space. The entryway, I remember there being this kind of legend that Dresser had all of the plans for the entryway okayed and kind of edited by Frank Lloyd Wright at the time it was built.
Yeah, I would not doubt that, because he had a lot of hold over his protégés and students, right?
One of the things I always think about with my hometown, Lake Geneva, and Frank Lloyd Wright is, of course, the loss, the destruction of the Lake Geneva Hotel. It was a building that was notoriously torn down in mm-hmm. the 1970s. And I think this speaks to a larger truth about Wright's work, the many buildings that he created and that have been lost over time. What are some of his more iconic buildings in Wisconsin that are no longer standing?
Well, definitely the Lake Geneva Hotel, and it went by three different names, so I'm going to use the Lake Geneva Hotel, and that absolutely would not happen today. I wanted to include that in the book so much because a lot of people don't know about it. I mean, if you were born after 1971 when it was demolished, how would you know about it? And I was so pleased. I thought, well, who am I going to talk to about this? Wright's gone. Many other people are gone. And I was so lucky to find a curator at the museum in Lake Geneva who had been standing there on the day that it was demolished. And she told me the story of that. And we both agreed that would not happen today. There would be, you know, international Frank Lloyd Wright enthusiasts coming to the forefront. And a lot of times, you know, buildings have protections now that will not allow that to happen. But in terms of ones around the state, there was another project in Milwaukee that is no longer, and that's the Arthur R. Monkwitz duplex apartments. Like the Burnham Black, they're on the south side of, they were on the south side of Milwaukee, built in 1916 and demolished in 1973. It's believed that they were demolished when the city was widening Highland Boulevard. And I think that's a huge loss because that could have been a model for how to create apartment buildings for everyday people, right? Maybe you can't afford the many dollars to buy a Frank Lloyd Wright house, but apartment buildings made them more accessible.
Now, we've really focused on southeastern Wisconsin, the kinds of things you can see in the city itself with a day trip. But there are many examples throughout Wisconsin. If you were going to go to just a couple throughout the state, where would you go?
Taliesin is really the best place to try to understand, you know, who was Wright as a person. He used that property, which is massive. It's in Spring Green, by the way. And he used that as a laboratory of sorts. A lot of times he would try out different ideas on a smaller scale. And he lived there. So if you really want to see what an architect likes, you need to go to their, you know, where they lived and see what gave them pleasure. And the landscape, it's just beautiful there. It really is a treasure, and people come from all over the world to visit that. And again, it's right in our backyard.
And there are a few places out west, it seems, that he not only created but really speak to his style.
Mm-hmm. In western Wisconsin, right. Yeah. In the Driftless region, there's also the building in Richland Center nearby that is in the process. It's a warehouse. It's in the process of being restored, and it's a very lengthy process. Anyone who is restoring these buildings deserves many medals because it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of community involvement. It also takes a team of experts who know how to not only restore historic buildings, but what was Wright intending. We can't ask him right now, but his ethos and his spirit is out there, and we can have a pretty good guess.
All right. Well, Christine, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your book with us.
Thanks, Joy.
Christine Hansen is the author of Frank Lloyd Wright's Wisconsin, How America's Most Famous Architect Found Inspiration in His Home State. Hansen will be at Boswell Book Company Friday evening for a conversation about her new book. You can find more information at boswellbooks.com. In about 5 minutes, we'll meet a Milwaukee Cricket League and learn about the sport. But first, if you plan your day around the weather report, you can thank the team of meteorologists at the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. We'll explore what they do and how they do it next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The weather is often the subject of small talk, but for a group of meteorologists in Wisconsin, the weather isn't just something to talk about with neighbors or coworkers. It's their life's work. The National Weather Service office near Sullivan tracks all of the weather in our area, from severe thunderstorms or tornadoes to sizzling summer temperatures. This team helps us plan our days. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang has more.
Growing up in Fond du Lac, Tim Halbach knew he was different from his friends. When storms started brewing, he'd be outside watching the action with his dad.
I was in high school when the Oakfield tornado happened, the last F5 tornado that happened in Wisconsin. So I watched that whole tornado go to the south of where I live, just a few miles away. And I knew something was different about me at that point because my friends were waiting for me to play euchre, and they kept on calling me like, hey, can you get over here? You know, we're waiting for you, you're our fourth. And I'm like, I'm watching this tornado right now, and like, aren't you guys interested in this? And they're like, no, get over here. So
Halbach is now the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. And when you're walking up to the office, the first thing you'd see is what Halbach calls a giant floating white soccer ball in the sky.
It's our Doppler radar, which basically we can see any storms that are happening in southern Wisconsin.
Every single weather alert on your phone or forecast you see on the television in the southeast Wisconsin area uses data that comes from this office and others across the region.
We are part of the federal government. We're the baseline for getting warnings out and letting people know when this all comes through. We don't make any more money if there's really bad weather or anything like that. It's just kind of our opinion and our take on the weather scenario and to what we think is going to end up happening.
And sometimes these forecasts or warnings could mean life or death. In 2021, multiple tornadoes touched down in Jefferson County, and these cyclones had gusts up to 110 miles per hour. Halbach recalls talking to a family who heeded the warning from the NWS forecast.
I'm one of the experts that goes out and surveys tornado damage after we've had a tornado, so I basically, along with other staff members here, will go up and down the path of where a tornado went to document what happened. One of the houses that got hit over by Concord in Jefferson County here, the people went down to their basement preemptively. Their family went to the basement and had just like a game night, and they're like, hey, there's storms that are coming through tonight. Let's just sleep in the basement tonight. So storms came through, tornado hit their house, and if they had been in their bedrooms up in the top floor of their house, they might have been injured or kids might have been hurt had they have been there when that tornado came through. So that was a time where the forecast helped make people take good actions and it kept them safe.
Halbach and the other meteorologists don't do this work alone. They all get some help from their neighbors across the state.
We have people that just report to us what they're seeing happening. So a lot of volunteers that just, you know, they're interested in the weather and they measure the rainfall every morning and they tell us what they're seeing. If there's bad storms coming through, they might be spotting the clouds and reporting to us what they're seeing with that.
And the office also hosts free storm spotting classes in the spring to prepare any level of weather enthusiast.
So we just kind of go through, all right, here's the information we need to know, and this is how you can report it to us. So a lot of it is through Facebook or Twitter or just online or finding our phone number and being able to report to us that way. But that's one of the main ways. Otherwise, we have people that help out with just rainfall measurements and snowfall measurements because we want to know how much we got here so that we can predict what happens with the rivers or how much snow needs to be plowed and things like that.
Wisconsin weather isn't always predictable, but we can always rely on the diligence of our local weather forecasters.
It doesn't feel like a job a lot of the time because we are looking at stuff that we probably would be looking at home, even if we weren't meteorologists. But the part where we get to help keep people safe is probably the biggest part of it.
For WWM, I'm Mallory Chang.
Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Sullivan, Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Cricket is a worldwide sport, one that's very popular in Southeast Asian countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. Milwaukeeans from those communities have been playing it around the city for decades. As global cricket gears up for its World Cup this fall, WUWM's Mayan Silver has the story of one local league.
Move over, Milwaukee Brewers. We've got another sport in town where you can pop open your favorite beverage, sit back and hear the crack of a bat. And this ball and bat sport doesn't have the limitations of a diamond. Nikhil Chand is explaining the rules of the game to me while balls whiz past that he and others are trying to field.
I'm not used.
I'm watching it, don't worry.
We're standing in what would be a baseball outfield, except cricket doesn't have those limitations. You can hit the ball anywhere, and it's in play.
You know baseball, right? So in baseball, it's just
the front V, right? But in cricket, it's just all around. And the pitch?
The pitch is a large strip at the center of the field that looks like a track lane. That's where the bowler runs down the track and lobs the ball at two batters on either end of the track lane. The bowler is like the pitcher in baseball.
So there are going to be two batters who are going to be running back and forth. Yeah.
Wait, do you throw the ball to both batters?
Yeah, you can throw the ball wherever you want. Typically, you're going to throw the ball to the person who you think wouldn't make it to the other end. So that's how it is. So you got to communicate well with the team. It's like a team game where you communicate. So
how do you communicate?
You just yell it out, I guess.
When the batters hit the ball, they score points by running back and forth to the two stumps at opposite ends of the pitch. The stumps are called wickets, and there's a catcher, too.
So the catcher is called the wicket keeper, by the way.
The wicket keeper.
Yeah, wicket
okay.
Keeper.
Wow, it sounds like something from Harry Potter.
Yeah. Just like the gatekeeper. Yeah, wicket keeper. Those are the wickets. The stumps can also be called wickets. So wicket keeper.
There are several ways to get out, including if the bowler hits your wicket when you're batting or if a fielder catches your fly ball. Except for the wicket keeper, Nikhil and the other players are not wearing gloves.
It's just like bare hands, and you got to be careful. Personally, I've had like 4 or 5 fractures on my fingers.
But that doesn't stop cricket players.
I mean, once your fingers get injured, you learn to, you know, catch the ball even better. So
this team
that's
is called
I
the Milwaukee
my
Cricket
lessons.
Club. They're part of an 11-team cricket tournament in Milwaukee called Regal T20. For most of the men in the league, like Nikhil, cricket is a cultural touchstone.
Yeah, it's like home, basically. Cricket is...
How does it connect you to your culture in particular, having grown up in a place where it's really popular, and then now being in a place where maybe the majority population doesn't necessarily play it or understand it?
Yeah, I just feel like... So in my workplace, I'm the only Indian in my workplace, and it's great to be like explaining this game to others so that they know what it is about, they know where we are coming from, and they know... what we play.
Nikhil feels fortunate to have found cricket in the U.S.
It's like a happy thing for us.
Do you guys socialize outside of the games and
yep.
stuff?
Yep. As a team, we go out for dinner. I think of us as a family. You know, that's how we could communicate better. We could have like a better understanding. At the end of the day, it's a team sport, right? So you need that understanding within each other.
Players come from all different cultures and religions and speak different languages, including the team's bowler, who's from Afghanistan. That's of no matter, says Nikhil.
First year, he couldn't speak a lot of English, but the thing that united us is going to be cricket. We spoke through cricket. So it's like, I think it's much more than a sport. It's a language, it's an emotion, it's everything.
Mohammed Shakar is the gregarious captain of the team.
In cricket, I'm known by Shaq, like Shaq O'Neal, actually.
Shaq has been playing cricket in Milwaukee since 1996. But like many Pakistanis, he started when he was small, playing in streets or alleyways with makeshift wicket stumps.
So there was no traffic. So they gave us a permission to have 3 little holes so we can put the stumps in. And I remember we stayed all night, almost like 3 in the morning on the weekends to play cricket because there was no traffic was there. And making those holes was a big event for us, you know, because we were making holes in the main street.
Shaq marvels that the city gave them permission to make actual holes in the road. He recalls that parents then parked their cars on only one side of the street so that the kids could play in the other section.
So parents and, you know, families, they sit on the buildings and watch us, you know, kids playing. And that is just something amazing. And we still, now when I'm talking to you, I'm getting a goosebumps by thinking that time. You know, I'm 40 old now, but I was 9 years old and I think 8 years old, 9 years old when he started that. So that was awesome. That was awesome memory to have.
Shaq explains that cricket goes way back in Southeast Asia, originally because of British colonialism.
In 1940s, they were, you know, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, they were all one country. So when English were ruling there, they were there. And they introduced that game. And it's called gentleman's game too. You wear white pants and white shirt and white shoes.
Jack says that's how the game started. But then, India was partitioned in 1947.
But the English people left, but the game stayed there. And that was the first sports were introduced to, you know, when new countries were made.
Cricket is now a gigantic sport in places like India and Pakistan. And Shaq notes that gone are the days of all white uniforms. They're now of all colors and styles. At this afternoon's cricket practice, for instance, Sid Sinha had a very localized dress code.
I'm wearing a Packers hat.
Even though you're playing cricket?
Of course, it's Wisconsin. You're not allowed to choose any other team.
Sweet. The Super Bowl of Cricket, the International Cricket World Cup, happens every 4 years. It's coming up this October and November, with three games in the U.S. Shaq, and likely all players in Milwaukee's Cricket League, are thrilled. Mayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
That report from Mayan wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the new PBS Wisconsin documentary called Wisconsin Pride, which highlights hidden LGBTQ+ stories and reconsiders our state's history. Plus, in the return of Bubbler Talk, we'll meet a local sign maker who may have worked on a few things you recognize around town. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Baby girl, let me explore you. Hit a six for you. When I see you catch, I applaud you. Every time you move in the crowd, me, I go on.